This is the Senate Consumer Business Affairs Committee meeting in room 315 on Monday, June the 2nd, 1975.
Order. The chair has two or three things to say before we get going so that we all understand what's happening here. We have a whole list of bills for work sessions. If there's anybody in the room who is here anticipating that this committee will get to the other bills other than medical malpractice, I think you'd better come back about 11 o'clock tonight, because I don't think we're going to be considering any of those bills except the malpractice bill today. We intend, it's my intention, that this committee will continue to work today until we have agreed upon a bill, can send it for amendments so that it will be on the floor of the Senate on Wednesday. And so that means that we're going to put in maybe some long hours here. We will be subject to a call of the Senate, which means that at any time there is a call of the Senate, we will have to leave the meeting to go to the floor to vote on the measure that is up for consideration at that time. As soon as the call is off, we'll come back up and pick up again where we left off. That might give all of you an opportunity for a break, but sometimes it happens often and you just have to bear with us. It'll be as confusing to you as it will be to us, but I think that this meeting can be well organized so that we can progress as rapidly as possible. It's my intention not to take any testimony whatsoever. I realize that there are a lot of you who are here who have personal interests in the bill, but I think probably you're here just to see what the committee's going to do and how we approach it. We've had hearings, we've had a lot of discussions, and there are a lot of ideas, and what we're going to try to do is simply pull these ideas together into the best bill that we can possibly make to present to the Senate. So with that, I ask Mr. Cooney, who represents the Oregon Medical Association legally, and Mr. Rawls, who is the insurance commissioner for the state of Oregon, if they would both come up to the table so that we can begin to get this show on the road. And Mr. Rawls, I'd ask you to, for the benefit, I think, of the members of the committee that perhaps have not been in on all of the kinds of discussions that have been taking place and all the kinds of proposals that have come from various members of the committee, as well as OMA and insurance people and attorneys, if you would review for us and for the people who are here and concerned about the bill, what has happened, where we are, what we have to look forward to for making decisions. The rest of the committee, by the way, will be up. There were two of the others had bills that were going to be up within just the next two or three on the agenda, and so they'll be joining us.
Madam Chairman, for the record, I'm Lester Rawls, Insurance Commissioner for the State of Oregon. And in a brief summary of the background of our plight that we find ourselves in that House Bill 2647 speaks to, I'd like to say that this is a problem which is not necessarily unique to Oregon, but to almost every state in the United States, and every legislature in the United States has been grappling with the situation. It's one that is very, very difficult, and I'm sure most everyone in the room understands that. There is no quick and easy answer to it. Many of us wish there were, and certainly those people in California and New York and many of the other states would hope to find some quick and easy answer, but not there. The situation as we find it in Oregon is that the Continental National American Group, insurance company out of Chicago, Illinois, has a contract with the Oregon Medical Insurance Medical Association to write their medical malpractice coverage. We are now in the last year of that contract. It began May 1st and expires on May 1st of 1976. The other remaining doctors who are not members of or who do not subscribe to the coverage under the Continental National American Group, which is underwritten by or underwritten for the Oregon Medical Association, are insured for the most part in the St. Paul Insurance Company. It's my understanding that there are approximately 900 doctors insured by the St. Paul. The other approximately 2,000 are in the Medical Association group. The contract that the Oregon Medical Association has agrees that they will underwrite any doctor who is a member of the Oregon Medical Association and, of course, is licensed to practice in the state. So those doctors who are now find themselves being not canceled but not being renewed by the St. Paul are covered or can be covered through the Oregon Medical program. Now the question arises, will that coverage be available in May 1st of 1976? Recently, the Continental National American Group, by the terms of their contract, notified the Oregon Medical Association that they were exercising their right under the contract and advising them that, in words, they would not renew the policy in 1976. However, I want to hasten to add that that was merely a procedural move by the company because it was called for in the contract.
Mr. Rawls, do you have that letter?
Yes, I have a copy of that letter.
Would you read it, please?
The letter is written April 24th, 1975, directed to Mr. Robert Drunetti, executive
director. By whom? Who's it written by?
It's written by a Mr. Victor Blake of the Continental National American Group. The letter reads as follows. Reference OMA/CNA Physicians Protection Program. With the current very serious situation in many states regarding the continuing availability of medical malpractice insurance, it is perhaps not surprising that in Oregon, rumors and speculation about the status of the Oregon Medical Association CNA program. In order to try to bring some order to this situation, I would like to outline CNA's position. We have an agreement which runs until April 30, 1976. We intend to honor that commitment. The decision as to whether we can continue for a further year, effective May 1st, 1976, will be made in December of this year. If we can amend the requirement notice condition to 120 days to allow for that. It is a difficult situation and one in which we cannot prudently commit ourselves beyond a year at a time. However, we are hopeful that the efforts of the past 4 years, the diligent efforts of the Professional Consultation Committee, your tireless efforts towards major legislation reforms, will all create an improved climate which will allow our decision in December to be an affirmative one. I trust this will be helpful in keeping things in perspective. I spent about 5 hours with the president, the senior executive vice president, and Mr. Victor Blake and other members of that committee on Friday, going through the reserves, going through the whole program. Their position is pretty much what's outlined here. Unfortunately, the contract called for a year's notice. A year in this volatile type of market is way too much to try to predict what's going to happen a year from now. They would hope to be able to say in December, and will say in December, whether or not they will continue. When the question was put to them, what would their position be if they wrote the business or were put on the spot today, they said they would continue with the policy. They are hopeful that the premiums that they have now in effect would be sufficient and will be sufficient to carry them through and adequately, actuarially sound enough to fund the program for additional year. So there, what it boils down as regards to the Continental National American Group's insurance program and their feeling presently is an affirmative one towards continuation of the program in a year to come in May of 1976. But I hasten to add, and in defense of that, that there is not a company in the business which can tell any group or any group of people that they will be in the business a year from now. I say that based on my close relationship with the six vice presidents who handle this business for the six companies left that are writing it. It's not unique to just Continental National. It's with all the companies. They just cannot tell for sure where they're going to be a year down the road. Hopefully there will be sufficient legislation, changes in the physician attitude, less malpractice claims and so forth, that they'll be able to continue. So where we have now then in Oregon a contract which covers all doctors. The contract is viable for at least the next 11 and a half months. The provision covers that any doctor who finds himself without coverage through one of the other carriers can get it through the Oregon Medical Association. The attitude of the Continental National American Group is that they hopefully will continue. I also had a call this morning from Mr. Tom Kellogg, who is a vice president of the General Reinsurance Company, which is the largest reinsurer of medical malpractice in the United States. Who they reinsure both Continental National American Group and the St. Paul in the state of Oregon. And his call was to tell me that he had heard rumors that they were not happy with Oregon, and they wanted to dispel that rumor. He said, we're going to stay there. We're going to be there next year.
Question, Madam Chair, that this
understood.
Did, have you had any indication that the 900 doctors who might be phased out by St. Paul would have to be members of the OMA before they could acquire insurance, or is that a requirement?
Mr. Cooney advised me that is a requirement. The next question would be, I don't know how many wouldn't be members of the OMA that would have the coverage available.
Well, I'll get to that later. Thank you.
But it is a requirement.
Chair?
Chair Cook.
Did you discuss with the, maybe you plan to get to this, with the people at CNA, as to what, if any, effect a limitation on the individual liability of a physician by law would have upon the availability and cost of insurance?
Yes, Senator Cook, I did discuss that, and I've discussed it also with a vice president of the Aetna Insurance Company on Saturday, a meeting I was with on medical malpractice also. And their position is this, and also with Tom Kellogg, who I just previously mentioned, and General Reed. The feeling generally is that a cap of this type is in the Indiana law and a couple others. Is not going to be one which they're going to put a great deal of stock into because of the straight question of constitutionality. As Mr. Kellogg said, the reinsurance business is a very technical, involved situation, and they're not going to change their formula for handling that because of a cap until they see some jurisdiction that is adjudicated to be a constitutional program. And reinsurance anyway doesn't work on that high a cap. It starts, you reinsure an individual loss and you reinsure an aggregate. And the individual type of thing is much lower and you have different levels in it. So it says the reinsurer's position is that the cap would not change their position as far as General Reed goes. Now Mr. Cooney has talked to somebody else that has a different view on that, I believe. Mr. Singer, who is vice president of the Aetna Insurance Company, which is probably one of the largest, if not the largest, writer of medical malpractice in the United States. He and I discussed this, and not only for Oregon, but the Indiana bill. The Aetna's position is, as regards to the Indiana bill, which has a limit on it, that they're not going to write the business in Indiana at all, because they don't want to be involved in several of the problems they foresee in that type of legislation. And he is of the feeling, their legal department is of the feeling, that won't be held constitutional just as soon as successful. So they cannot rate the problem they find themselves in Indiana is a demand by the legislature that they pass this law that the rates then should be reduced because of this cap, which they feel won't be held constitutional when it's tested. So they're being asked to write at a lower rate, which is not actuarially sound for the type of risk they're going to have to assume. So the Aetna's position is they're not the right business in Indiana. They're pulling out because of that legislation. I might also add, just as an aside, and I met Saturday with the committee I was meeting there, had the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the state of New Jersey, retired, Judge Weintraub, and I asked him just briefly what his position was, and of course, I'm sure you can understand this, he was very hesitant about making a judicial determination with that very fact. He felt just as a hypothetical, as my question was hypothetical, that to a individual group of people, to limit their liability, and also then carrying it one step further, limit their liability as to just a part of their act, which, for instance, a liability would be limited if they injured a person by use of a scaffold, but it would be unlimited if he did the same thing by the use of a car, would be, again, one question which would he would find hard to hold the limit to be constitutional under the what he knew of the what I was giving him under the New Jersey law.
Madam Chairman, while we're on the subject, as you know, Madam Chairman, we've been attempting to find alternatives for the past week and discussing every opportunity for alternatives, and one of them, of course, was the self-insurance program in House Bill 2647. So, Mr. Cooney, it was my understanding as of the last time we met, which was not too long ago, that the question of self-insurance for doctors hinged on reinsurance, and reinsurance hinged on a cap rate. And I would like for you to answer the question, which the insurance commissioner posed, there's no reason for a cap rate. And my understanding from your organization is without a cap rate in the self-insurance program, you cannot get reinsurance.
That's the information that was given to the agent for the OMA, that the reinsurance company would not take it unless they had a cap rate. And I guess we're at the mercy of the information that we received from the insurance company. It's my understanding it's a different reinsurance company. I might throw this out. Maybe this isn't the point to do it.
Is that sufficient to bring us up to date, Madam Chair?
I think so. And let's turn to Mr. Cooney now and let him tell us what's going on.
In attempt to try and solve the question of the cap or limitation, which is the controversial issue, this proposal has developed, which perhaps has substantial merit. Legislation along the lines that we have requested, authorizing the necessary legislative changes for the creation of a self-insurance program. Elimination of the amount of limitation in awards but a provision that states that any licensed Oregon physician who carries $500,000 professional liability insurance with any insurance company, and who in addition thereto pays a stipulated sum, perhaps $500 per year, to a malpractice surplus pool managed by the department of, under the auspices of the insurance commissioner, shall be immune beyond that point, and that persons who recover judgments in excess of the $500,000 which is available under an insurance policy shall look solely to the pool created by this contribution and administered by the insurance commissioner. And then the insurance commissioner would pay those judgments which are in excess of the $500,000 insurance coverage. And if it could either be on the basis that it's prorated depending on what's available in the pool, or it could be on a first-come, first-served basis.
Just a minute, are you through explaining? Let me finish explaining the whole.
I think that's...
Well, the only point I want to know, whose information was that based on, or whose statement on the $500,000 for the first insurance? I think you stated initially that this was based on information you got from somebody.
No, this idea is one that has evolved from discussions with myself and members of the plaintiff's bar as an attempt to solve the problem of the undesirability of a limitation and yet recognizing the needs of the physician to have some point beyond which he shall not be exposed or be required to pay in the amount of premiums. This is merely saying that any physician who carries professional liability in the amount of $500,000, be it St. Paul, CNA, or a self-insured program, and who in addition to carrying that coverage contributes, let's say, $500 a year to a surplus fund to be administered by the insurance commissioner. Once having met those requirements, the physician is immune beyond the amount that's available under the $500,000 liability insurance and that which is available in the surplus fund to pay those limited claims which exceed the $500,000.
Mr. Kinney, how much you would assess? Is that a one-time assessment of $500?
No, it would be an annual. It would be just like
so
a...
So it would be added to the premium?
Yes, it would be a building fund.
What's the expectation for the fund, $500 per all of your OMA doctors?
Well, I would think that this would attract all of your physicians because this would have a feature which would cause them to contribute to this because it offers them something that they can't buy in private industry. They could, by contributing this, could put an absolute protective lid on their personal assets. And this would, I think, attract private industry to make their $500,000 coverage available, and then the doctor would gladly contribute the additional premium into the fund because then he's buying unlimited coverage.
Senator Smith.
Well, let's see, just for discussion purposes, if we have 2,000 MDs at $500 a head is $1 million,
yes.
in the reinsurance fund over $500,000, and the plaintiff's bar agreed with you on this proposal.
Do they agree?
Yes.
Well, I don't know if the whole bar is, but those that are active in the area do, I think, concur in this view.
Well, that's interesting. Let me ask you then, Mr. Cooney, if there are two cases of $1.5 million or more, that cannot be covered under the $500,000 limit, and the reinsurance program is dissipated, who's going to take care of the judgments?
Well, there's two ways that that can be handled. Let's assume that we have two verdicts for $1 million each. The primary insurance, whatever company it was with, would pay the first $500,000. That would leave each claimant with half of his judgment satisfied. The remaining fund of the surplus with the insurance commissioner could be made available to pay it entirely on a first-come, first-served basis. And the bad part about that feature is toward the end, if the fund's exhausted, that person may have nothing. But each year, the fund is being regenerated with that contribution.
May have nothing over $500,000.
Pardon me?
May have nothing over $500,000.
That's right, at that point. Now, the alternative way to paying from the surplus fund 100% on a first-come, first-served basis is to pay it out on a delayed basis, pro rata, so that you might have to delay the payment for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years. He's already received the $500,000. But then, during that period of time, you would know the judgments that would have accumulated out of that 1 year's occurrences. If there was enough money in the fund to pay 100% of the dollar, the claimant would receive 100% of the dollar. If there was insufficient, then those who have the judgments over the $500,000 would prorate among themselves the amount of the fund that's available. Perhaps 50 cents in the dollar, 90 cents in the dollar, whatever is available. Then this fund and this contribution that is required must be actuarially sound, so that 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years down the line, if it develops that the judgments have repeatedly exhausted the fund, then it would have to be increased. It takes away the total cap limit and gives the claimant an opportunity to recover over a limitation from this surplus fund. Now, admittedly, it may be that sometimes he will not receive 100% of the dollar, but it doesn't lock him in to the cap limit. And the difficulty in determining this is what formula you use, or the commissioner uses, in dispersing. Our emergency medical fund for highway accidents disperses 100%, as I understand it, when the fund is available. And if there's no money, the people have to wait. That's one way of doing it. The other way of doing it is to delay the payment until all the judgments are in that arise out of that 1 year, and prorate so everybody gets a fair amount. The disadvantage of that is the delay, and the delay is occasioned by our long statute of limitations.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Cook.
Well, I'd like to take one.
Wait, hold on. Just, okay. Continue, Senator Smith.
Just one statement. I'm fascinated that the plaintiff's bar would agree to something like that. I guess it's justice if you get in early concept. That's all I have to say.
Senator Cook.
Why couldn't you follow that up with a procedure whereby this is a continuing fund so that an arrangement is made to adjust the annual excess premium so that a person who obtains a judgment eventually will recover the entire amount, either directly or by an assessment?
Well, I think the idea would be that it would be a continuing fund. The difficulty that you would have would be this. Let's assume that we made it $500 this year, and there was a $15 or $20 million verdict. And if it was retroactive, you would be going back, subjecting physicians to unlimited assessment, which I think is not a viable alternative. I think what you do is you say the contribution for the next 2 years shall be $500. At the end of that 2 year period, if we find the fund has been insufficient, then in order for the doctor to buy this immunity, instead of paying $500, he's going to have to pay a sum that is actuarially sound. But to make it retroactive and accessible back would, I'm sure, be an unsatisfactory solution, because in effect they would have no protection at all, that they could go back and be reassessed at any time.
Your
fund would be building.
You're not stuck with the sum of $500. Are you recommending that this surplus fund be a figure that is actuarially sound now, whether it's $500 or $1,500? In other words, is it going to be actuarially sound based on what you know?
So, yes.
Whatever the figure is.
Yes.
You're not stuck with $500. It might be more, it might be less.
Yes, but the problem is we can't come up at this time with any closer figure than $500, because we don't have time to run an actuarial study. And what we'll have to do is have some experience. The first year, if you had 2,000 doctors, you've got $1,000,000. It takes usually at least a year, more probably 18 months, for our claims to generate the judgment. And by the end of the second year, you'd have $2,000,000. Now, at that point, you can then have a actuarial projection as to what the risks are of cases coming into that area where you're going to have more than a $500,000 judgment, and calculate a reasonable charge to be assessed to the physician for the payment.
Senator Brown.
Are you suggesting that there won't be any comparison of risk between the specialties?
Well, this is the reason when I said that the doctor for X number of dollars would pay $500 into this fund. It may be, and this idea is so new, having come today, that we really haven't had an opportunity to evaluate. Perhaps it would be unfair for the GP who does no surgery to pay $500 for that same coverage as the neurosurgeon. It's premature in this last hour's talk for me to come up with a recommendation on that. The figure of $500 was discussed, and this was an idea that it would be generating about $1,000,000 a year toward the availability of a fund to take those care of those claims in excess of $500,000.
Just to answer that question, Senator Brown, I was looking at the new and old classification and the new and old rates for the OMA, which is put out by Mr. Donetti, and looking at the new rate for $100-$300 for a Class 1, which is a GP, is $1,116. Up to $1,000,000, you're paying $1,552, which is almost $400 difference there. Even if you start out with just $500 for the lowest classification, he wouldn't be so far off than what he's buying right now, because he'd only have to buy up for $500,000 for the primary, and then pay $500 over and above that. I might add, if I could, just that in my discussion with the CNA people on Friday, that they're looking right now at the fact that maybe those 1, 2, and 3 classifications are underrated for the amount of losses that are being occasioned by that classification. As we've all heard, we put all the burden on the higher classes, the 4 and the 5s, the high risk. But they're finding out that the GPs and some of the internists and so forth are now developing losses which they hadn't projected. So there may be merit in raising their rates to bring them up higher to the Class 4 anyway.
Well, how would you do that with a statute that create the insurance fund and say there has to be, in the first year, a minimum of $2,000,000 in there, and then give you rulemaking authority to?
Well, as Tom pointed out, it's brand new. I would say that we could have some rulemaking authority as to the establishment of a fair and equitable rate to establish this pool. It could go that way. If you start out at 500, you're going to have a million the first year, and as Mr. Cooney points out, you may have, by the time that any person would tap this fund, you could have upwards of $2 million in the fund to start off.
Well, how would we be sure that you safeguarded this fund? For instance, the current problem seems to be the stock market. How would we know that you would do the same thing?
Well, I suggest that you, I asked that question, I'd be the only one to have to write a check and I could take off the Buenos Aires. I suggest that any check that the commission would write would have to be on the approval of the Attorney General. Because certain...
No, I'm talking about the fund. Surely
yes. I think that should be handled by the state treasurer.
Okay.
I might add this. I think that... I think the passage of this bill is saying that a physician carries $500,000. We're going to have some of the constitutional worries that we have on limitation. And I don't think you're going to be able to find that a physician will only buy the $500,000. He may have to buy more until this likewise is tested constitutionally. But the feeling among the lawyers is that it runs less risk of a constitutional encounter than does the outright limit, because you haven't removed the right for unlimited damages. You may have postponed or delayed or caused a proration, and it's not as pregnant as the questions that are raised constitutionally on the outright limit. But I think that you cannot anticipate that the physician will be paying a premium to whatever company for only $500,000. It may be for the first year or two he's going to have to carry in excess of that until we get tested. But the likelihood of a cost saving and the granting of, in effect, total insurance for the $500 is certainly worth it from the physician standpoint.
Senator Cook.
What about adding to this concept the one that I think Dick Noble has mentioned, in any judgment in excess of whatever amount, $500,000, you would be paid off on an annuity basis? Now, wouldn't that tend to
the commissioner could have
make
authority.
A better probability of solvency of this fund?
Yes.
It would have to operate, though, within the limitations of the judgment. The doctor has a judgment against him, doesn't he?
Well, the plan would be this. Let's assume the doctor had a $2 million judgment against him. Upon payment of the $500,000 and upon proof that he has contributed to this surplus fund, the judgment would have to be satisfied against the doctor. He would have his $500,000. He would then have his right to look to the surplus fund, and wise underwriting, as you suggest, would dictate that it perhaps be paid on an annuity basis, and thus eliminate some of the problems that you're faced with dispersing your fund too quickly.
Well, if you had it on an annuity basis, I would think it would give a considerably greater probability that you wouldn't exhaust the funds.
Senator Smith?
Well, Mr. Cooney, If you're going to go for that program and are advocating it, then I'm curious as to, and you say this question about the constitutionality of even the one you're proposing, I'm curious as to why you don't continue with the program that you're advocating prior to you got to this one. Let me finish. And I understand that, let's assume it's a $500,000 lid. You have a guarantee from an insurance company for a $50 million aggregate cap of reinsurance. If you're worried about the cap being unconstitutional, it appears to me that you could provide that any doctor could be covered with any insurance company at $500,000 and pull them together, and you could get the reinsurance lid over $500,000, and you don't have to fuss around.
That's right.
I don't understand why you're going for another alternative.
primarily because of the opposition to the cap theory and the expressed disapproval by certain members of the committee that they feel that that is unfair. And
you devise that I'm in the minority again. That's what you're really trying to say.
No, I appreciate it. This
no, you're not. Two or three times you've been over on the other side.
This is an attempt to try and find a middle ground to answer the objections that are raised in the minds of the committee and the lawyers as to the fairness of the cap.
Senator Burbidge.
You stated that if this scheme that's been discussed, the most recent one that Senator Smith seems to have taken some objections, even were to be put into effect, that doctors would still feel that they'd have to carry additional liability insurance. And also, I think I heard you say, and other members or other people who testified, with or without, with a lid, with 2647 as it originally came over here, that doctors would have to have considerable additional liability insurance for a number of years until the constitutionality were tested. Is that correct?
That would be a wise decision to do so.
I think you stated it at one time even stronger than that, but not only would it be a wise one, that the doctors probably wouldn't dare practice without it.
Well, there's some that carry no insurance now, and that's the reason I say it would be a wise decision, but not all would follow.
Well, I think, Mr. Cooney, it's important to distinguish between the lids we're talking about, and one of them is that the doctor is covered up to $500,000 liability. That's his insurance. The other lid we've been talking about is how much the victim can recover, and they're two entirely different things.
Sure.
And a doctor can cover up to whatever he wants to, and then if you've got something that's going to cover him for the remainder of it, it seems to me he's home free.
Well, the idea of this bill is to, in effect, say that he shall carry $500,000 coverage, plus he shall contribute this certain sum to the pool, and therefore he is then immune beyond that point. Now, until such time that some higher court in Oregon says, yes, that is constitutionally valid, he may have to carry for his protection more than the $500,000. But once that is determined, and it's more likely to be determined constitutional than the cap, then he can cut it down to the straight $500,000. There should be a drastic reduction in the premium.
Okay.
This
is one alternative. There have been other alternatives, and I'd like for those to be presented to the committee so that they know there are alternatives and so that we can choose among them which we think should be written into the bill. So what about the one of your reinsurance, Mr. Cooney?
The one that I was brought to my attention on Friday was the philosophy that the state would lend the money to the self-insurance company.
Yes.
And as I expressed to you, Senator, and Senator Smith, that this would not be an acceptable method for a self-insurance company to function. And I think the easiest way to explain it, without getting into all the details of reinsurance and so on, would be simply this. It's like saying to you, don't buy your car insurance anymore. Take your $300 a year premium and put it in the bank. And if you get hit with a judgment or a settlement of $40,000 or $50,000, take the fund that you have in the bank and apply that to the judgment, and the state will lend you the other $48,000 or $50,000, and you can pay it back to them.
I'd ask Senator Smith, because this was his idea. I fail to see any distinction between what you have proposed and what Senator Smith proposed as that pool for the second to insure. You call it whatever you want to. Call it reinsurance or call it a compensation fund. But the doctors contribute to it and take out of it. Take out of it on an annuity basis. But if it goes broke, the third step was a loan from the state, from the treasurer.
The first step is the first $500,000 worth of insurance is paid for by a premium.
Right. And that was his proposal.
And that is all the doctor would pay. the second step that's different is for the upcoming 2 years, the doctor will only pay, let's say, $500 for unlimited coverage over the $500,000. Now, it may be true 2 years down the line, the cost for that right to pay into that surplus fund might be higher, but it doesn't relate back and make him reassessable and liable as a loan for the indebtedness that occurred the first 2 years.
Madam Chairman, could I interject a question?
Well, I want to ask Senator Smith if, because this was the proposal that was worked on for some time. In fact, we even have amendments and a mocked-up bill here out of the AG's office. I thought that it was Senator Smith's proposal that that second fund would operate in very much the same way as you have proposed your second fund to operate, and that there simply would be the backup from the state treasurer should it get into trouble. What you're saying is that with no backup, if it gets into trouble, you simply then, somebody has to decide what to do.
I think that's what you're, I think I'm saying that.
Do you agree with that?
Well,
Madam Chairman, the difference is that, of course, you understand that in the reinsurance pool, if $500 isn't enough on the proposal, then the judgment is reduced over $500,000.
Or the claimant might not get full recovery under the
program. He might get 50 cents on the dollar, or 75, or depending on how they want to prorate it, if they want to prorate it, or if it's first come, first serve, the first guy gets his primary of 500,000 plus $1 million, the second guy gets nothing over the $500,000. The other program was to ensure that no matter what the judgment, if the pool ran dry, there would be a loan to the pool to make it cover all of the judgments over the $500,000.
Just to be clear, but under your proposal, there could be an arrangement made whereby the claimant would ultimately, whether it's annuities or having to wait for a period of time for the renewal of the fund, get the total judgment.
No.
Well, this is the problem that we don't have the solution to yet, and this depends on how you administer the fund. The first day the fund starts, if you got 500 from 2,000 doctors, you'd have $1 million right off the bat. It would occur to me that it would be better to delay distribution until it is known who the potential participants may be in that fund. They would have already received the basic $500,000, so they're not left without remedy, without compensation. And then, at the end of that time, you would know whether or not the fund was sufficient to pay 100% on the dollar, or whether each person that has that larger judgment might have to say, we'll discount it 20 cents on the dollar or 40 cents on the dollar.
But if you began to pay it out on a monthly basis, it wouldn't run it dry unless you had a whale of a lot of claims in 1 year.
Yes, that's a way of delaying running it dry.
Yeah, and at least you'd have some experience upon which you could face whether or not that was even going to be tapped.
That's right. I think there'd have to be a discretion in the commissioner to devise a system of appropriate distribution. One of the ideas would be obviously a money-saving device to pay these on an annuity-type basis.
Okay, Senator Cook.
And what if we also were to give authority to those administering this fund to purchase excess coverage?
Yeah, I'm catching.
With the payments that the physicians made into the fund.
Well, there would be a little concern with the physician how the fund was used.
In other words, one of the possibilities, I would think, would be if adequate money were paid in, you'd have an annuity backup as an option, but the other option would be to simply, if it were available, to purchase excess with this fund, which was created by the physicians themselves.
Sure.
I mean, that should be included as one of the options in the fund.
Mr. Rawls, you've been wanting to say something.
Well, I just, thinking out loud, I think that Senator Cook's two suggestions there, the annuity, if that could be worked out, trying to run through my mind whether it should be a mandatory situation that anything would be paid on an annuity basis or at the discretion of the person administering the fund. The hardships may be, I suppose that's something to work out later. But then the thing was, I was thinking about what Senator Cook just suggested, that you could, for fear of running this dry out, that certainly for a nominal fee, you could reinsure anything over $1 million or something like that, so that the reinsurers, not only have they got $500,000 deductible, but they got $1 million deductible, and they'd be reinsuring over and above that out of this. That, it seems to me you could almost guarantee full payment out of this. It's kind of new.
And what you might do here, too, by this system, at the committee last week, we had Dick Noble was testifying as to one of his clients who had to settle for the limits. If we can somehow give something to the person that they don't have now, then we're not really just taking away. What I'm thinking of, perhaps you can devise a system that will really give better protection to the consumer than it currently has. And by the combination of these thoughts that have been brought in here, maybe the individual would have better protection because the physician will be encouraged to participate in this program.
Senator Brown.
I seem to have missed the point. Where does the first $500,000 come from?
That would either have come from private industry or, as I indicated, past the self-insurance request that we have, so that if private industry was not available, we could do it with our own self-insurance program. And that way we're only carrying $500,000 worth of insurance in effect, and we'd have it backed up with this big aggregate which we have to rely on.
Okay, Mr. Ross?
Well, it's kind of the question asked about the difference between this, I think, and Senator Smith's, where we were anticipating in that only reinsuring the those that were developed from the self-insurance company out of the general fund, where this would be, as Senator Brown has asked the question, would be a pool, regardless of whether they had their business with their underlying coverage with St. Paul, CNA, self-insurance company, Aetna, whatever it might be. It seems to me that this would be a better program in that than have more acceptability than drawing from the general fund that we discussed as a problem with the special company.
Okay, now, what about any other proposals? Mr. Cooney, you can create your own insurance company and then hopefully just hope for reinsurance. That's
third
alternative.
Not sure.
Yes, the self-insurance program with a limitation is the one thing that we've had before us. The other is...
Or without a limitation. Just either way, you hope
yes,
for reinsurance.
Yes, my advice to the OMA is if there's no limitation, don't chance reinsurance, self-insurance. But that is an option. You could pass nothing and or pass the bill allowing them to go self-insurance, but knowing in advance they probably could not. And those are the only alternatives that I can think of.
Well, there's another one. OMA, self-insurance, with then a joint underwriting to back it up.
Yes.
What's your position on that, Mr.
Well, I was going to say, let's not forget what might happen, and if both of those two alternatives collapse, we still have...
You don't need a self-insurance. I mean, you don't. They don't have to go together. You could have a joint underwriting bill, and under that, the commissioner designates one company to run the show, and whether or not a self-insurance program was created would be really irrelevant. They could do it if they wanted to.
health insurance system.
Well, whatever program's adopted, it looks to me like you've given up on the idea of a limit.
We haven't given up on it, Senator, but I have talked to the various members of the committee, and I know some that have strong opposition to it, and this was considerable concern that we might end up in a deadlock and getting nothing out of the Senate, and the impact that this may have on the medical profession. I think it's important that this Senate committee come up with a bill that offers some hope to the physicians, and my fear was is that a limitation had such a diversity of opinion among the senators on the committee that it might die for lack of approval, and that that would be a horrendous consequence to the profession and to the public. This was, we felt, an alternative which could be lived with by the doctors and could be lived with by the injured claimants.
This is probably off the subject to a degree, but what happens to a doctor, or what liability does he assume if he refuses to, let's say, operate or take care of a patient, but for some reason or other he wants to limit his liability and refuses to give care? What happens to him?
Probably nothing if he hasn't undertaken to treat originally and then abandon the patient, but the physician is not required to accept a patient.
Do you think there's conditions arising out of this type of legislation that might bring that about?
No, on the contrary, I think this new idea probably has more appeal to the physician than any form of private insurance, because by buying the basic and contributing, if it's constitutional, he has immunity. Whereas in the present system, he never buys immunity. He just has to buy more and more insurance, and his personal assets are protected up to the amount of the insurance, but no more.
I don't see where he has any immunity in this, any system advanced today.
Well, this, maybe I didn't make myself clear here, that this portion of the bill provides that if the physician buys $500,000 and pays $500 into the pool, he is personally immune, and the injured claimant can look only to the $500,000 insurance and that which is available in the fund.
Sure.
And the doctor is immune beyond that amount.
Senator Smith.
What changes in the dollar rate would you anticipate upward with the program that you have just put forward?
I do not think at this point it would be an upward.
Would it be downward?
I think it would be downward slightly.
Downward from what?
Well, from your present rates.
Downward from the proposed increases, or downward from what they're paying as of today? The new contract is the May 1st. What are we talking about?
It's in effect May 1st. It's
all right. And that's the horrendous increase that we've all been reading about, and that's the one that the doctors that are semi-retired are going to quit, and the young doctors are going to starve to death. What are we doing? I mean, we're not helping that question, are we?
Master, is that time?
Go ahead.
A doctor, Senator.
Dr. Smith, that's my father.
I know.
He's a judge.
I think that, I'm sure that there are physicians in this room with disagreement, but looking at the payments that they're making at the present time are not out of line with the exposure and the certainly not in excess of those that are being paid in neighboring states around the same locality. But looking at the class six, as they call this, which is ordinary a class five, a physician is paying upwards for $5 million of the coverage, which quite a few of those carry, $12,000. And his basic up to 100, 300 would be $7,000, so it's $5,000 differential there, so that if he were immune from anything over $500,000, and had to pay $500 over and above that, I'm sure that, as Mr. Cooney pointed out, he's going to carry some excess coverage for this. But he's going to have a considerable amount of savings down the road.
Okay, what would be the cost of the insurance? Should we go to a cap of $500,000, as you initially indicated, with an aggregate of $50 million above that for reinsurance?
It depends on what points you have reference to, and it always has to relate to the constitutional decision.
Well, so does the other one.
They all do, yes.
Sure.
And you are not going to immediately cut your premiums in half because you have reference to a cap of $400,000 or $500,000 or under this program. The idea of the cap plus the self-insurance program was that the self-insurance company, being local with fixed costs, could, by close operation, cut its costs, plus the fact that the aggregate insurance is cheaper than the insurance on the individual claim. So the thought was estimated that a straight self-insurance program with a cap would the first year hopefully cut premiums 20%. Now, down the line, when it's contested somewhere and you know whether it is or is not constitutional, you're collecting a premium hinging on that possibility. But if it were determined constitutional, then your premiums would be cut drastically, because then you'd be writing only for the $500,000. But you cannot promise that the first year or two. But it was estimated, and rather carefully, that a self-insurance program would cut the rates around 20%.
Well, let me ask you one other question then. Would it be possible, with a $500,000 cap rate, to organize the group like you're proposing, asking each doctor to pay for the first $500,000, put in a cap, and then ask for a reinsurance aggregate over that? Would the insurance company go for that on a pooling agreement?
Well, in effect, that's what they're agreeing to do now, because we say we think it's constitutional, and they say, all right, we'll go along with you, but if it isn't, we're there. And
it's a little different, Tom.
Well, perhaps I didn't catch the pulling cord of your.
Well, the difference. Well, my only question was, is it possible, you think,
to have a self-insurance program up to $500,000?
Well, now wait a minute.
All right.
I'm not talking about the self-insurance program. I'm talking about a pooling, allowing them to buy from any company that's providing it, and I think we need to provide you with the tool of self-insurance. I'm not, but to pool everyone, would your reinsurance company, after you had pooled them up to $500,000 with a cap, would your reinsurance company aggregately insure up to $50 million?
Yes.
Okay.
Another plan that was discussed, and Dick Noble and I have talked about this, was an idea of having an actuarially sound projected premium for the doctors for malpractice, and have that fund placed in limbo or with the insurance commissioner. and have those people that have claims be required to look solely to those premiums for their recovery. And that way then you have a totally, completely self-insured program. In other words, the premiums, like it's estimated, I think, that $8 million in premiums will come forth from this new rate proposed by CNA.
Thank you.
You could take the $8 million and put it in the fund, assess your costs, what it would cost to investigate your claims and try your lawsuits to defend the doctors. And let's assume that left $7 million, or whatever it might be. Then those claimants who have approved settlements or obtained judgments for occurrences arising out of that 1 year would be required to look solely to that $6 or $8 million fund on a prorate basis. That way, then, you have a totally self-insured program, but from the claimant's standpoint, a possibility of not recovering 100% on the dollar. But that way you have a fixed in, the premium fund is available to pay those claims arising out of that year, and all those that share in that prorate.
Mr. Noble, since you've been discussing this with these other gentlemen, would you come up and take the third chair? The third wheel in this thing, lawyers, doctors, and insurance people. For the Indian chiefs, the Indian chiefs are those lying in the hospital. I wonder if you'd make comment about this proposal from the standpoint of the legal profession.
I can't speak for any member of the legal profession except myself, but we have talked to a few other attorneys who are familiar with the problem that handle this type of case, and I think that there's some enthusiasm for this as a compromise. The goal, as I think Mr. Cooney and Mr. Walls both expressed, is that this will ultimately result in the plaintiff or the victim receiving his full compensation. That's the hope. Certainly, he would get $500,000 that the doctor would be insured for. In the event that the claims above the $500,000 exceeded the amount that was generated by this assessment, which, as I understand, would be subject to review from time to time to find out whether it's adequate or not, there is the risk that if there was not sufficient money in this excess fund pay all those claims 100%, then that person would have to take some kind of a discount on his judgment in excess of $500,000. So it's a compromise. But I think it meets the doctor's needs, which we recognize as being important. We hear this talk about, you know, doctors may walk out and strike and go have a situation as we did in California. I think it meets those needs. Certainly, everyone who has a claim that's proven in court would get that first $500,000. Probably, he would get whatever the jury concluded that he should receive. He would have a risk of perhaps having to take some discount. It's a compromise. I think it's a compromise that both sides can accept and live with. And we would recommend it to the plaintiff's bar.
What would your position be on the excess first in, first out theory?
No, I really like the idea of the annuity, and that too is something of a compromise. Rather than waiting 5 years till you know all the claims are out and then paying, I would think that as the claims came in, that the insurance commissioner might start paying on an annuity basis. This would be paying out some, and then at the end of the, say, the five-year time when the statute of limitations is run, then those people would be paid off in total, or would have to take some kind of a discount at that time. I think there could be.
Would the annuity per month be based upon the award given, so that it would simply be divided by X number of months and be paid off by the
end of the statute of limitations or by the end of the judgment period?
Well, I think that whoever is the administrator, whether it's the insurance commissioner or someone else, I think that they should have some broad discretion, because we don't know at this time how, if we're talking about one claim in 2 years or 10 claims in 1 year or whatever it's going to be. It's only as we gain experience that he can develop rules that will best fit the need. I think that the insurance commissioner should have a backstop, again, that when he pays money, that he would petition to the court for approval of whatever his payment plan would be. So if there's some objection to what the insurance commissioner is doing in paying the claims or withholding payment for a period of time, the court would approve it. This would be similar to what we do now in the settlement of a minor's case with the establishment of a guardian or something of that sort. I think this would insulate the commissioner from a lawsuit for potential liability on his own if somebody claimed that he was paying it out arbitrarily or withholding it arbitrarily.
Okay, one more question and we'll get to Senator Cookin. How do you feel about the constitutionality of this and the comparison that was made before this committee of setting workman's comp claims and so on? Those were assurances to the victim, and so he gave up his right to had to claim more and so on. How do you square this kind of a system with that kind of a system to make it constitutional?
Well, I'm not going to pretend to be a constitutional law expert, and I don't think that anyone in this room or the Attorney General's office, for that matter, can tell the committee that the Supreme Court's going to rule it's constitutional or unconstitutional. All I can say is that I believe that this approach, this compromise approach, has the ingredients within it to improve the chance that it would be held constitutional, because it's not a limit on the patient's right to collect as such. He collects the $500,000 if he gets the excess judgment and has the opportunity, which I think is the goal of this legislation, is that he will collect his full amount. But there is some risk that he may get less.
Senator Cook.
All right, now, I think there are two ways one could go at this concept, and I'm not sure which you're for, or maybe you haven't really thought it through that far. Maybe you have, maybe you thought it through farther. But are we going to talk about a continuing pool, thinking of the annuity, a continuing pool that on a continuing basis would be sufficient to satisfy the annual annuities that might be payable? Now, that's one alternative, I would think. The other is always looking back to the primary year, which I would think, for just as an example, you could have in the year 1976, $2 million, you know, in judgments of all kinds. Now, if you had to look back to 76 ultimately, then you might almost guarantee be a much greater probability that you'd have to prorate than if you had a system with a continuous pool which would continue until such as long as the continuous pool were solvent. Now, have you...
The latter would be the better approach, because that would essentially assure the patient that he's going to collect his full judgment. The risk in that, Senator, is that maybe 2 years from now, or 4 years from now, or 10 years from now, the whole pool will end. It may very well be that 5 years from now, the whole insurance problem, or 4 years from now, the whole insurance problem is solved. The economy has turned around, the insurance companies are making money on their investments again, and there may be a lot of competition in the medical malpractice insurance field. And the doctors at that time may decide to close up shop on their self-insurance program and buy it commercially again. I mean, what is created by this legislature may not necessarily last forever. If it did, yes, I agree that it would be on this continuous basis that you're talking about, rather than looking to a set period to pay the claims that arise in that set period. But I don't think we can be sure that that's going to be possible.
Well, couldn't you perhaps get the best of both worlds? Maybe it could be provided that until such time as the fund is closed, that it would pay on a continuing basis. And upon closure, then it would revert back to available funds on a prorate basis.
That could be. This is a good point as to why I say I think that the administrator of the fund should have some discretion, because I'm sure that the goal will be to work out the most equitable system. and I get him, partially because the idea is new, and we're, I don't think that any one of us think that we have in mind at this time the most equitable system. And I think that some discretion should be left to the commissioner to work that out.
Senator Smith.
Mr. Noble, do you think that if a judge renders a judgment of $700,000, that it's constitutional for the state of Oregon to tell the man that you're going to get the first $500,000, but we're going to suggest that you take the next $200,000 in annuities?
Well, we've been dealing, and I think that you, Senator Smith, were ready to vote for an absolute limit. And certainly, this is more acceptable from a constitutional standpoint. And as I say, I can't tell you what the Supreme Court is going to do.
The reason I ask you, I picked that up across the street in, in the Attorney General's office, and granted, he doesn't know anything about it either, I understand. I have one other question.
Senator Smith.
How would you feel about limiting the contingency fee to 25%?
You know, this is, I think that everyone that's involved in this issue who has gotten the figures is in agreement that the contingency fee has absolutely nothing to do with the medical malpractice insurance problem. And the only argument in favor of limiting the fee is hopefully if you can cut the fee low enough, the plaintiff won't be able to find a lawyer to represent him in court, so that claim never gets presented. And I'm opposed to placing the restrictions on the fee.
Well, I think I didn't agree to that, but it seems to me that, you know, 33 1/3% of $500,000 is a bunch to represent any client in
you
a judgment.
It is.
And other states have approached this on the question of, well, we've looked at New Jersey, which has a maximum fee schedule, and I don't know how it turns out, but it's it diminishes in percentage as the judgment increases. What would you think of something like that?
I'd like to see the schedule that's proposed before I could. I can't comment on something that I haven't seen what your figures are. I don't think that the legislature needs to be concerned about the welfare of the plaintiff's lawyer, but I think you do need to be concerned about the welfare of the public and their ability to retain a lawyer to represent them on a particular type of case. And I'm fearful that a restriction on the attorney fees will deprive these people of an opportunity to get a lawyer. There is no type of litigation in existence today that carries with it a greater risk that the plaintiff's lawyer is going to work for nothing than a medical malpractice case. And of course, the statistics from the insurance company bear this out. If the contingency fee system is valid at all, and I submit that it is, there's no type of case where it is more valid than it is in the medical malpractice field.
Well, I'm not concerned about the plaintiff's bar either. I know you'll get along fine, but I am concerned if, on the one hand, we're in effect jerking a lid off of the judgment situation, and on the other hand, we're suggesting that the contingency fee is as high as 33 1/3%, and some law firms, if it goes to the Supreme Court, it's 50%. And I just don't think that that can be justified by anybody.
Okay, we have a call to send it on. Senator Brown, you have a quick question before we go, because I want to leave some instructions with these gentlemen.
What happens to Dr. X if he gets a $2 million judgment against him? He's 60 years old and he retires at age 62.
Well, under this proposal that's being discussed this afternoon, he is free of liability. His insurance, assuming that he participates and buys the $500,000 policy and he's paid his other $500,000 into this fund, he's home free. He doesn't have to worry about any future assessment or any personal liability.
Senator Okay, we are on a call to the Senate for the committee members. It's on the corporal punishment bill in school, in the public schools. You want to know what you're going to go down and vote on? I don't know what the motion is. It's up. Is it on the bill itself, Bob? Okay. Would you three talk to yourselves while we're gone about what you would recommend to us to write into this bill? Talk to Mr. Joe
Bukowski
from Legislative Council, who's here, about your ideas. When we get back, we want to make a decision on what kind of insurance plan to write into this bill. Here. Might say your doctor to her last said her asked me if we had a bill yet, and I said no, but it's like being in labor.
Madam Chairman, if I might pick up, we haven't had an opportunity to get together. Joe was trading us around. We were trying to work with a different group, and there are one or two other items that the hospitals, of course, are concerned about, the possibility of their being in or out of this program. And I suggested, Pete, that they, as they do in Florida, there's an assessment against each hospital bed. Quickly, what the hospital assessment would be have to be determined. I don't know what the thought is of the other two parties to this triumphant about the hospitals. I suppose they have to be considered.
Well, Pete, where have you been for the last 6 weeks?
Just through this proposal today.
Well, you weren't concerned about being involved in any of the other proposals.
Yes, I was concerned, Madam Chairman, but we were protected in the other proposal. But this one kind of leaves us as the co-defendant holding the sack, as it were.
Well, what's your answer, Mr. Cooney?
Well, I'm sure that they have had, this is such a recent development, I'm sure that the hospitals have not had an opportunity to evaluate the matter. I haven't had a chance to talk to them.
Well, we're not going to hold up the bill for the hospitals. If the hospitals want a bill to take care of themselves, we perhaps can manage that. But as I said, there's going to be a bill go out of this committee tonight. I'm concerned about hospital safety, but, you know, everybody's been talking with everybody around here for weeks and trying to figure this thing out.
Well, sit down. Madam Chairman, would it not be possible to include hospitals in this thing with the same sort of relationship, paying into the fund as well as carrying a set amount of coverage through premium?
Well, who are you going to buy your primary? You're going to cover yourself. Primary insurance, right?
Well, we could do that either through the same reciprocal company that the doctors have, or through a private carrier, which is now available to us.
Hospitals are not in the same position now as doctors are in terms of cancellation or higher premiums.
It's not that critical with hospitals now. It could be a few months hence, but it isn't in this state today.
Senator Cook.
Well, why shouldn't we just leave them out then? And we have a critical problem with the MDs, and let the hospitals continue to maintain the coverage they've been maintaining.
Well, if I may, Madam Chairman, our problem arises when the plaintiff has an award for $2 million, either co-defendant is liable for the whole amount. And if the doctors cover the extent of $500,000, he pays that in, and they then go against the hospital for the remaining $1.5 million. And the fund into which the doctors have been contributing pays nothing. And it seems to be inequitable, in my judgment, and it seems to me that the hospital rates then would continue to go up, or perhaps even accelerate under those circumstances. It doesn't seem to me that it would mess up the bill, the proposal, to include doctors and hospitals, since there are benefits to realize when both entities are insured by the same insurer.
That'd be like putting together, it's kind of like the rabbit stew, and
France that they stole. Half rabbit and half horse. One horse and one rabbit. And wouldn't it be kind of ridiculous to put a hospital in on the same basis as old Dr. Jones?
Not the same basis, Senator. I think there should be a contribution that's fair. And I think that could be worth it.
Now, are you talking about only this pooling? You wouldn't buy OMA insurance. That's going to be only for the doctors. So you'd first insure yourself with some company.
Yeah, my proposal is that the maximum apply to both, whatever the primary source of insurance is, whether it's the OMA program or some other program, and that both be in the pool.
What you might do is work out some. I think the pools would have to be separate, but that the hospitals could contribute to a pool in some amount on some formula, based on beds or whatever, and be in the same position, but separate.
Mr. Fletcher, the Florida law provides $1,000 per bed for hospital in their compensation pool.
Is that, Madam Chairman, for the whole coverage, or is that for a pool beyond the set amount of coverage?
It's my understanding beyond, isn't it, Lester?
I'm not sure, and I hate to answer. I wonder, Madam Chairman, if are you planning on breaking for lunch, or lunch, dinner?
We have no plans at all.
If we'd like to take a dinner break, that we could work together with Mr. Lesner and the Joe, and we could come back to hash out some of these answers and have something for you to discuss.
We might check. Jerry, would you go down to the Senate and find out what President Bo's plans are, and before they're not the Senate?
He's going on until 7.
He's going to go to 7.
Well, Madam Chairman,
and then break for the rest of the evening, or come back.
Madam Chairman, I know that this is contrary to your stated wishes, but I'm going to have to leave shortly, and there are others, obviously, aren't here. They're somewhere. They have a lot to work out. Why couldn't we meet at 8 o'clock in the morning and give them...
We have judiciary at 8 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, we won't take all that long. How about meeting at 7 o'clock in the morning and then breaking for judiciary for a short while?
You want a conceptual motion?
Well, you just missed out on the goodies, so we've got to include the hospitals now. That's the hang-up.
There's
the first time we've seen him for 6 weeks.
Oh, you
there is this problem.
That's not very in the case.
3 weeks, maybe.
But we were protected on the other one as I watched him evolve, or the other ones. But this one, I think, is really adverse to our interests. And I don't want to mess up the bill, but I'd like to see it's protected also. And I think it's possible without messing up the bill.
Well, there are two or three, there are some other amendments that obviously have to be made in this bill. And there, I know that there are some wishes of the committees that they want to propose some amendments to the bill. But this is the thorn that we've really got to take care of, because this is the main point of the bill. How long do you think it would take you people to work out something?
Mostly it's an hour. There's some real advantages in including them, because it creates a larger number of people who are going to be contributing to the pool and makes the pool more likely to work out, I think. I think the big question is, actuarially, how much should they be paying per bed? And at this point, I think we're just guessing at figures.
Well, Madam Chairman, I make a suggestion that we adopt conceptually a position without the hospitals in, that the hospitals come in with amendments, and I'm sure there are others here who might want to amend the conception after the motion is, if it passes, but that we basically begin drafting language which would provide the alternative that has been in excess here, plus provide for the self-insurance program that's now in the bill as a backup procedure, and that that language be drafted as soon as possible, return to the committee, and then other amendments might be accepted or rejected at that point.
Well, I think there's separate, Senator Smith, and I think that we could take the other amendments so that we could go ahead and give direction to legislative council to take care of the other amendments while taking care of this problem and have the bill carefully gone over, and instead of returning it to committee and or anything of that sort, we just report it out to the floor. So it'd be my desire that if we can't work out this right now, that we adopt conceptually the proposal that you've made to us, that you try to work in the hospitals, and that we would meet tomorrow morning at 7 o'clock to go over those amendments.
That's a good idea, man. Mr. Noble, with one provision, that you do not charge us a contingency fee on your time between now and 7 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Okay, you guys can get to work on the insurance part of it. I know you want to hear what else we're going to do to the bill, so, and if you have comments, we will consider them. I presume with that motion that we can now move to strike the provisions that set a limit on the plaintiff's recovery.
I so move, Madam Chairman.
Okay.
Well, was that motion accepted?
No.
Oh. Well, prior to the time that I'm going to remove anything, I want to make sure we have a direction, Madam Chairman.
Did your motion that, and I didn't put your motion to a vote either, so I'll back up. Did your motion include the whole philosophy that has been expressed here?
With the $500,000 and the $500 overrun with immunity.
And that there would then be no liability limit to the plaintiff in the bill.
That's right.
That's with the little niceties, including the annuity for that amount over a certain amount.
All right. If you think you can get away with a flat annuity, I think you ought to look at the option. In other words, the optional annuity, but if you think you can get away with the annuity, it's fine with me.
The annuity and the option to buy reinsurance or excess insurance.
Well, I meant optional annuity was my concern.
There's no lid on the plaintiff's recovery.
No. Well, that's what I'm asking, Bob, is that if the total thing has been agreed upon by these three people are included in these motions.
I'm willing at this point, if they're proposing at this point, and I don't know whether it's going to fly or not in the House. I don't care about that. But at this point, their proposal was a $500,000 insurance program that the doctors would buy either from private insurance or through self-insurance, and that they would contribute $500 over that, and they would have immunity at this point, and within their self-insurance program as well. At this point, I'm willing to give up the cap rate to get the bill going and get it drafted.
All right, then a part of your amendments, Joe, would include the deletion of subsection 1, section 13. So we don't have to take a separate motion on that.
And Madam Chairman.
Now, the discussion of Senator Smith's proposal.
Madam Chairman, if I understand it, the instruction would also include the preparation of language to provide for the alternative of excess insurance by this fund or payment on an annuity basis or both.
That's fine.
Is there any further discussion? And, of course, you're going to try to work the hospitals in. But you intended to include that.
Well,
Bob's motion was that we let them come up with amendments tomorrow, is what they're going to want.
Well, all right. The motion is we're going to get the doctors in here, and then they're going to work with you, Pete, to see what we can do about it.
I prefer to look at a proposal for the hospitals in the morning and not involve that in the basic bill that we're trying to build at the moment. If we have agreement on the basic bill, I don't know what the hospital thing does to the total program. Might blow it up. I don't know.
All right. So, then there's no motion. The motion does not include hospitals. It simply is a matter to be worked on to see what the group comes up with. Is there further discussion on the motion? The motion is that we adopt conceptually. The proposal has been made by the three gentlemen at the table on self-insurance up to $500,000. After that, the pool that the doctors pay into and the be paid out on an annuity basis. And that's just
does it involve the state?
No. No. Clerk will call the roll on the motion.
Senator Brown?
Aye.
Senator Burbidge?
Aye.
Senator Cook?
Aye.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
Aye.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Jernstedt?
He's absent.
Madam Chairman?
Aye. Okay, Senator Smith, recognize you for motion. I'm going to clean up it. No, I want you, if whatever, you had another motion you want to do. I'm going to recognize you and Senator Cook for two motions you both told me you had to make. The locality rule, you want to reinstate the locality rule? Senator Smith moves that we reconsider the vote by which we deleted Section 11, page 10 of the bill.
Madam Chairman, to the motion.
Okay, Senator Smith.
Madam Chairman, I just believe that if there's a problem with the language on the locality rule, and that's the one that says that you may only use in testimony before the court a doctor within the locality or a like locality within the state of Oregon for purposes of proving or disproving malpractice. If that language is too restrictive, I'd want to change it. But my purpose in making the motion is to provide that doctors in Oregon judge doctors in Oregon. And I don't have to remind anyone that of the difference in practice in California and in other states, and the differences in the court reaction in other states. And I just believe that it's, in all fairness, if we are going to provide in this bill, the kind of bill we have, that Oregon doctors ought to be called upon for evidence against Oregon doctors. That's the point.
Okay, the motion is to reconsider. Senator Cook.
I'm opposed to this motion, and based on the experience reported by the lawyers who've handled malpractice cases, which is that it's extremely difficult to obtain a physician to testify against another one in this state. And in many cases, unless one were able to go to a community similar to the communities in Oregon to find a physician, that in those cases no one could be obtained. And so the injured plaintiff would be without a remedy. The present law permits, as I understand it, a physician from anywhere within the kind of a community, like I suppose Redding, California, if you could bring a physician up from Redding who could testify in the case in, I don't know, a comparable town, maybe Salem or Eugene. And there's no good reason to so limit it, because you are going to prevent some people from obtaining a witness, at least in the present state of the law in Oregon, where you cannot subpoena an expert witness.
Other discussions of the motion? Clerk will call the roll on the motion to reconsider.
Senator Brown?
No.
Senator Burbidge?
No.
Senator Cook?
No.
Senator Howard?
Aye.
Senator Powell?
No.
Senator Smith?
Aye.
Senator Jernstedt? Madam Chairman?
No. Motion fails. Now, Senator Cook, what's your...
All right, I have a proposed amendment here on the same subject. I don't have enough. Oh, you have enough for everyone. On page 11 of the printed Engross bill, after line 12, insert the following. Section 13A. One.
We've deleted all of line, we've deleted section 13 totally.
All right. Wherever. All right.
Okay.
All right. Just wherever it fits.
All right.
This would be the amendment. In any civil action brought against a person licensed under ORS chapters 677, 678, 679, 682, or 683, or any health care facility in the state of Oregon licensed pursuant to ORS chapter 441 for alleged professional negligence, when a party wishes to require the attendance of an individual before the court in order to obtain that individual's expert opinion on matters relevant to the action, the party must, before or during the trial, present a written motion to the court requesting a hearing to be held to determine whether the court will issue a subpoena to that individual requiring him to appear before the court and state his expert opinion. Sub 2. If, after a hearing, the court determines that the individual whose appearance is sought has sufficient skill, knowledge, or experience so that his opinion will probably aid the trier of fact in the search for truth, the court shall order the appearance of that individual as an expert witness, I'll add this, to express his opinion. Continuing on the next page, when a party requests the appearance of an expert witness under this section, he must tender to the court at the time of the hearing held under this section the fees, expenses, and mileage of that witness. I still move that amendment.
Could you explain your amendment?
Okay, now, again, I'm not one who has any experience in this business, but it's my understanding that the biggest problem that is encountered by litigants in a medical malpractice case is in finding a qualified person who will express an expert opinion. It's been called by some the conspiracy of silence. Now, if we really want to get at the problem, we really want to make sure that any physician who is liable for malpractice or negligence or whatever, we need to make it possible for that issue to be brought before the court. The effect of this proposed amendment would be, or it is introduced to accomplish this effect, that let's say that a person were involved, claimed malpractice in something having to do with the orthopedic surgeon's arena. They would, in order to avoid abuse, they would come before the court and say, we request that Dr. Schuler be subpoenaed and brought before this court, and upon the presentation of a set of facts to express his opinion as to whether or not the conduct alleged is or is not, or does not amount to a condition which is negligence. And the way it would work, they would file a motion, there'd be a hearing, the court would then require this physician to appear after requiring the plaintiff's attorney to post to the court an amount that the court found to be reasonable to compensate the physician for his time in connection with that testimony.
Okay, the two people who are involved in the legal profession, Mr. Cooney and Mr. Noble, I realize the first time you've seen the amendments, first time I've read it too. Do you have any reactions?
I appreciate the sentiment expressed by the proposed amendment. I don't know. I thought all along, and the message, if any, that I've been trying to get through on this thing is that really we're talking about an insurance problem and we're not talking about a torts problem or a claims problem. And what Senator Cook said about the difficulty getting a witness is absolutely true. I am not in favor of attaching to the bill changes to the tort system, things that perhaps are going to make the whole thing more difficult to get through, more opposition to the bill. I'm doubtful, seriously, Senator Cook, one of the things that crosses my mind is that the doctor who's compelled to be present in the courtroom probably isn't going to help us anyway. If he can only be brought there as a result of a subpoena and being ordered there by the court, his testimony is going to be so equivocal and backtracking and reluctant that it probably isn't going to be much help to us in the patient's cause in any event.
Can't you subpoena him already?
You can subpoena him, but I can tell you that if the doctor is so opposed to your cause, or so opposed to the idea that he's going to have to testify in a medical malpractice case, that the only way you can get into the courtroom is under a subpoena, he's going to figure out some way in their testimony to shoot down your case. Just give him a chance, and I don't want to call that kind of doctor.
But on the other hand, Dick, isn't this kind of like giving him a little moral backbone? A high-quality physician who knows his business when presented with a state of facts is not going to deny that this state of facts is not. It does not show a lack of negligence.
Well, if it's a cut-and-dry situation, black and white, but I can tell you that when you get into these cases, there's a thousand questions involved. It's sort of like this bill. And you might say this was negligence, but for this reason, I don't think it had anything to do with the outcome. I think that basically what I'm trying to say is that I would prefer, from my standpoint, that the an insurance bill not to be burdened with changes in the tort system on either side, because I think that the tort system works pretty well. And for that reason, I don't think it's a compromise.
Senator Burbidge.
I think, the maker of the motion, or some of the motions that struck some of the other language that got into changing the law, the liability part of the law. And I feel just as strongly about trying to put some salve on to make it better. I don't think that that's the problem that we originally are here to address. The entire problem, as I understand it, is to make insurance available to doctors and to make it available as cheaply as possibly can. And I'm opposed to doing anything else than to try to make insurance available to the doctors as cheap as we can.
Madam Chairman, in view of the fact that...
You may close, okay? No, I'm going to take
Well, I'm about to suggest that I'm about ready to withdraw it at this time because I think the sting out of the bill, I think that if Senator Smith's amendment had been adopted, then this would really be in order.
Right.
Because that's probably the only way you have a shot at it. Or if there were a limit adopted, then it would really be in order. Now I can appreciate Dick Nolan's point.
Senator Cook withdraws his motion, and there's no objection to his withdrawal.
The other motion that I was interested in, I'd like Lee to present that in the morning, because again, it relates to hospitals like the other amendments that we're going to be hearing tomorrow. And
Senator Cook, you presented that amendment once.
And I want to present it again tomorrow.
And there was a motion taken, there was a vote taken on
right.
that amendment.
That's true. But then we've revoted on a lot of things in here.
I know, and the chair will continue to exercise her own discretion as when we take motions. Ms. Cooney, would you and I guess Bob Durnetti take a look on page 7, section 3C? It's just one dinky little word there, but may or may not make the bill stronger in terms of your policing your group.
What line?
Line 19. The board on its own motion may investigate any evidence. Would you have objections to changing that to shall? No objection? Yes, there is objection. Could you explain? Dr. Payne says there is objection. Would you explain why?
Yes. The board will has numerous times where they can check out a complaint fairly easily without having to go through formal investigation, which we have to be documented, and they can handle a good number of problems. If they have a shall in the law, then this will require documentation that they did such and such and such and such, and they're going to be all tied up with material that can be handled relatively easily without great procedural involvement. this will strengthen it considerably. If we tie them all up with procedural involvement, then they're not going to do it as far as we seem to be.
Okay. All right. That was a suggestion, but we wanted your answer on it. Okay. We have Kaiser Hospital and OMA still fighting over a provision in the bill or a proposed amendment to the bill. Jay?
I came up with a statement of intent, which would not be a part of the bill, but would be written in the record. And that has been moved by the OMA and their agreement that is
okay. Does everybody have copies of that?
I know. We have moved the adoption of the statement.
Okay. Senator Smith moves the adoption of the statement of intent regarding the provisions in Section 1, Subsection 4, Subsection A. The statement of intent will be placed in the minutes and will be a part of the record for any interpretation by the court in the future as to the intent of this provision of the bill. Is there any other consideration that we should take up here?
Madam Chairman, I move that we adopt the statement of intent.
Senator Smith moved it. I'm sorry. I just failed to take the motion. Is there any objection to the statement of intent being written into the record? Okay. Motion's adopted. Sorry. Now, anything else, Mr. Cooney?
Well, there were a list of technical amendments.
Oh, that's correct.
Which I might bring to the attention of the committee.
It's a whole list of OMA's amendments.
And it's strictly technical. It's word changes rather than content changes.
You want to take us through those?
Yes.
Not just the technical ones. Don't get your others involved.
No, sure.
I know. I'm going to give them a read. Dick, we're not going to meet at 7. Before we get on this, let me, I just decided that maybe we shouldn't have to work all night on it. If we can be excused during the session in the morning, say around 10:30 or so, 10 or 10:30, you suppose you could all have this ready for us? Or at such time as you have the amendments prepared, inform me, and we'll get off the floor and have our committee meetings. Is that agreeable?
I just suggested to Joe that Tom and Vic and myself, Joe, meet this evening, give what we have to Joe that's in progress.
All right, and then that'll give you some time in the morning, then, Joe, to work on it. So when you're ready, okay, then you'll let us know. And Mr. Noble, we'll have to keep you informed of when we'll be meeting tomorrow. Or else you'll just be around. Yes. Make a good speech, Vern. Survival, like a graduation speech.
Are these technical amendments we all agreed on?
No, we haven't even considered. Do you want to? Probably take a minute to go through these.
5 minutes.
All right, let's go.
You missed it. Page 8, line 8. Subsection 2, if the board has reasonable cause to believe, ban, change to that.
Okay. Any objection to that change? Change, it may just be a typing error. Go ahead.
On page 9, line 22, connection with training, supervision, and should be changed to or.
Let's see, training, supervision, or discipline of physicians. Any objections? Stopped it.
Let me ask you why on that one, Tom.
The reason being that there was some concern that if the committee dealt only with a singular phase, for instance, training, as opposed to training, supervision, and discipline, that the immunity might not apply. And it's merely technical. The thought was that when you lump them together with a conjunctive, that it would be only a committee that viewed all of those subject matters which might have the privilege attached, whereas the intent was that a committee that dealt with training, supervision, or discipline would be subject to the privilege. And that's the only reason for the change.
But now this is current law that you're changing, so it makes a difference. How has it been working? As though it were or?
It hasn't been a problem yet.
Any situation?
And it's just a matter of trying to anticipate that someday someone is going to say, no, that privilege doesn't apply because that committee didn't deal with all three of those subjects. It was only a discipline committee.
Okay, satisfied, Senator Burbidge? Go ahead.
And then on line 28, a person serving on or before any, as opposed to a.
It's line
27.
Line 28.
Line 27, I'm sorry. A person serving on or appearing before any medical review committee.
Any objection to that amendment? Okay, it's adopted.
Where are we? 11. Yes, all right. Then in the self-insurance portion, page 11, line 17.
Okay.
Accept that and delete reciprocal and say an insurance company, including a reciprocal.
Accept an insurance company, and then you would insert after company, including a reciprocal insurance company.
Yes. And this merely gives the self-insurance program the option to go reciprocal or stock company.
Any objections to that amendment? Okay, go ahead.
And the same change on line 18.
Company to company.
No, on line 18, change the word companies to company.
Right.
That would be the change.
Company, including a reciprocal insurance company.
Yes.
Comprised solely of one. Okay.
Then on line 25, which provides coverage in the event the total fund of the insurance company, including a reciprocal.
Okay, same language then as above.
Yes.
Any objections to that amendment?
The rest is
okay. Go ahead.
And line 26, which is available to pay claims, delete the word received for, and insert for occurrences of.
Oh, wait a minute, I'm not with you. Start over again.
If you pay claims received, delete received.
Okay.
And leave for in, and insert after for occurrences of.
Of any one year?
Yes. Now that merely defines the fund which the aggregate insurance applies to. In other words, it says that when the fund that is available to pay claims for occurrences for any one year is exhausted, so that the premiums for 1975 are a fund, and when that fund is exhausted to pay claims for occurrences arising out of that year, then the aggregate insurance comes into play. And that merely ties the aggregate to the specific premium fund. And really is no change. That's the way it works anyway. And this merely makes it clear.
Are there going to be some changes in this now with this new plan?
Probably not. Probably not.
Okay, because you're still anticipating. Okay. Well, all right. We'll worry about that tomorrow.
This sealed deals. This should not affect the overall self-insurance plan. Then you would delete lines 30, 31, 32, and then on page 12, lines 1 and 2. That's all.
Any objections to that last amendment and the deletion that was offered? Okay, that's it. Okay, anybody else have anything they want to offer in terms of trying to get this bill in shape? Joe, I suggest that Jerry, whenever you need him, he's on call. And when you get the amendments done, he can already start working on these amendments that we've adopted to see if he can get us a mocked-up bill.
Has this proposed Section 13 been adopted?
It was, no, deleted, you mean?
The ones that are in his amendments.
Oh, no, 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 no. No, that's, we've not, this is the first time we've considered these amendments, and all we adopted were just the technical ones that he proposed.
We have leeway now to also change the sections referred to.
A lot of sections will have to be renumbered and that sort of thing because of the deletions that
and
have been
occurred. And also references to those sections.
But I think when the committee meets tomorrow, that whenever it is, whenever you're ready, and Jerry's got mocked up bills, that we ought to have the thing totally in front of us so we know exactly what we've got. And then we'll have to have somebody do some proofreading, you guys, on these technical things and be sure we've got a clean bill. Okay, is there anything else? Okay, please adjourn.
Go down to four.
No, this is the Senate Consumer Business Affairs Committee meeting in room 315 at 12 o'clock noon on June the 3rd, 1975, to discuss House Bill 2647.
I have inserted in that mocked-up bill the amendments that apparently Mr. Cooney and Mr. Noble have proposed. So I will ask the indulgence of the committee to mark up your own copy as who wants to take us through it, these amendments that were just made by Mr. Noble and Mr. Cooney. One of you tell us, you're going to have to tell us where, what line, what page, so that we can all conform our bill, and then we'll all be talking about the same thing.
May I ask a question?
Senator Burns.
They're going to take us through the latest amendments, and then somebody else is going
We're going to correct our bill. We're going to get our bill in the form in which they believe it should be in.
And then we'll go.
Then we'll start going through it. So if you would just, this is simply just an exercise in getting our bills in order so that they all look alike, and we're not worried about the substance of it, but after we get our bills all put together, then we'll have you tell us what you've done. So where do we start, Mr. Chairman?
Section 13, I think, is the first change.
Section 13?
Yes.
Page 11A.
Do you have the copy that Dick and I have?
We have the mock-up bill as Legislative Council's made its amendments. Then we have this set
you have
of
your
amendments.
Mocked up amendments.
All right, we've got the same documents.
I think this is a mockery.
Yeah, it is a mockery. Okay, let's go. We're set now. We don't have lines on this thing, so you'll have to tell us which paragraph and then which line and which paragraph.
Then I don't have what you have because I have lines.
On page 11A. Do you have the
preamble? Okay.
Jerry, do you have the preamble?
Yes, I do. I want that passed out too.
You want that on page 11A?
thing in the preamble too, those who want constitutional revision, we could just repeal the Constitution and put this in its place. It's just about that substantial, isn't it?
You have a copy.
Well, we've drawn a preamble, which is directed toward bringing attention to the offset or the giving of something to the public in the view of having favorable constitutional consideration of this bill by the court. And the preamble says that whereas it is in the interest of the public that Oregon physicians be insured for professional liability, and whereas it is further in the interest of the public and Oregon licensed physician that such insurance be available at reasonable rates, and whereas an Oregon licensed physician who participates in the plan set forth in this section and provides the designated limits of professional liability and contributes to the fund for the protection of his patients and himself shall be deemed to have fulfilled the objectives of this public policy. The theory of the offset or the giving of more is that in order to obtain this limited liability for the physician, he is required to carry $500,000 worth of professional liability. And in effect, that's an offset or a giving of...
Well, okay, therefore, any Oregon, what goes where? What's the dot, dot, dot?
All right. Then, therefore, we go into... Well, you can delete the therefore in the Oregon.
All right, let me raise a question here. It's, of course, very common to put purpose and intent into the law, but I don't know that I've ever seen it put in this form of whereases. I think it generally is stated.
That's poor lawyers writing these rules from contracts.
Do you have a copy of this, Joe?
All right, ma'am.
Okay, we should run these by the people that do the drafting around here.
Problem is, Madam Chairman, we just got these amendments for Connie to type up just before the meeting, and she...
Okay, if we're going to put a statement of intent and purpose in this proposal, it goes at the beginning of the whole provision, and it doesn't say whereases, it says it is the intent of the Oregon legislature that Oregon physicians be insured for professional liability. Right, Joe?
Yes, Madam Chairman. That was the difficult point.
So, if you want a statement of purpose, I'd suggest you let Joe put it in proper language.
That'd be fine.
And then decide at what point in the bill it is appropriately inserted.
Right.
So, can you kind of revise that language so that to make it right? Okay. All right, so the statement of purpose and intent is a proposal. Okay, now go on with the amendments.
Starting with section 13. When a physician licensed under ORS chapter 677 is insured by an insurer licensed and approved by the Insurance Commissioner of Oregon against liability arising out of professional...
Are you deleting the word legal?
Legal liability, I'm sorry. Legal liability arising out of professional negligence for the death, injury, or disability of a human being in the sum of $500,000.
Are you deleting the words of at least?
Yes.
Then tell us where you're doing that so we can mark our copy.
Well, I'm reading from the...
There's section 13 and subsequent sections typed up, but I thought it was distributed. It's just substituted.
Well, what I'm reading from is this new section.
On what page?
Four.
Page four of the proposed amendments?
Yes.
That you people have.
And that is the beginning. Of the new section 13. And that's what I was reading from.
Okay, all right. We just all have to be on the same page in the same place. So this is a substitute paragraph for Section 13.
Yes.
Did you run this by Mr. Kowski?
No,
part of it
has been.
He just got a copy of it as well.
Three paragraphs is an awful long subsection one.
Well, the problem that you get into is...
I'm worried about drafting as well as substance here, because I don't want a bunch of errors that have to bring this bill back from the floor of the Senate. You're going to delay another day or two if that happens. Okay, Well, Joe, can you run through that to see if there's any problems in drafting?
This is the first time I've seen
that. Yeah, I'm aware. We're asking a...
There's very little change in the first paragraph. Paragraphs 2 and 3 are totally new.
Okay.
And deal with the problem of claims made policies as opposed to policies based upon occurrence. And this is necessary because the St. Paul is now writing their malpractice policy under the claims made form.
Okay, what you're really doing, then we go on to subsection 2 on the next page, which apparently is almost identical to our current subsection 2, if not identical. So you're inserting two new paragraphs, is that correct?
Yes, with slight change in paragraph 1.
Slight change in paragraph 1, so then this is new and this is new. All right, so we have some new language in Section 13. When we go through and you explain to us, we'll include those two paragraphs with an explanation. Now, what's happened to Section 14? Are we all together now? Let's move on and see what's happened in Section 14. Any changes there?
Well, you have reference to a Section 14, and I don't have a Section 14. The next section I have is a Section 2.
Subsection 2,
yes.
In the middle of that page, you have Section 14.
Page 5. Could you tell me what page of the bill and what page of the amendment we're looking at?
Sir, if we are trying to make compatible page 11A, Section 13,
five.
With page 4 of the amendment, Section 13. In which they have made a slight change in the first paragraph and then have added two new paragraphs.
They've also deleted subsection 3.
And have kept subsection 2 reasonably intact, I guess, and deleted subsection 3 from the bill. Have you made any major changes then in Section 14? Or Section 15?
Madam Chairman?
Senator Cook?
Well, a question that suddenly comes to my mind. Was this written this way? Is there going to be any, what kind of leverage is there going to be on the insurance carrier to settle? Let's say you've got $1 million case. What kind of leverage is there going to be on them to come up with these limits? Aren't they going to be inclined to just sit back in the weeds and do nothing?
The insurance commissioner and the, let's call it the fund, is under this program in effect in the position of a similar to the position of a reinsurer, in other words, his liability for that fund comes into play at the exhaustion of the primary coverage. We have a provision in here that dealing with settlements about giving notice to the commissioner. And I would assume that he is in the same position to the primary carrier as an excess carrier is, which means that the primary carrier is subject to pressure from the insurance commissioner to settle those cases which are should be settled within the limits of the primary coverage, as the trustee, or not really the trustee, but as the keeper of the fund. And this is the way it works with, as between reinsurance companies. Now, if I'm defending the primary carrier, they have $100,000 limits, and the case can be settled for $100, it should be settled for $100, we get the same pressure from the excess carrier to settle the claim. And there is such a thing as bad faith cases between primary and reinsurance carriers.
Yeah, but what pressure have you got here? This particular reinsurance fund is not providing access to the primary carrier, so they can't threaten or imply that they won't again write that excess if the primary carrier doesn't operate in good faith. As I would read it, you couldn't have a situation where the injured person offers to settle within the limits, for example, that they just, the primary carrier, they can just look the other way, and so what? Because they're not going to be stuck beyond their $500,000 whether they settle in good faith or whether they don't.
Well, the only thing that I can offer in solution to that, I would assume that if an insurance company did that to the detriment of the fund, that the commissioner could bring an action similar to a bad faith case against the primary carrier.
Well, why don't we provide that in here? How would we draft language that would give to the fund the right to assert a claim against the primary carrier of bad faith? I can see a real problem in a very serious case. They just will say no and force the person to try the case, even though it perhaps should have been settled for, you know, $300,000 or $400,000 or whatever. Shouldn't we make it clear that the excess fund here would have a bad faith claim against that primary carrier?
You should then.
If they got stuck, let's say there was something. How about the equity? We're talking about protecting the fund.
Yes, I understand.
What if we were to give to the trustee of the fund some kind of a right to go against the primary carrier in case they don't exercise good faith? Let's say there were an offer to settle for $350,000. They examined it and it should have been settled for that. Just like now, Dick, I'm sure, has handled a number of these. He makes the demand, offers to settle within the limits, and then he can go ask him for an excess.
I think there's no particular objection to that, Senator Cook. I think that right exists now at common law, but writing it in is available. However, writing in the law of excess liability is quite a little additional task, which...
is that clear to you, Dick? I mean, if it really isn't clear, we ought to put it in, because this is a whole new statutory scheme with a whole, it's not the injured person here, it's the fund that's involved.
I would think that the trustee of the fund or the insurance commissioner would have the same authority under the common laws that exist now with insurance companies, where they can request settlement within the basic coverage, and if the insurance company refuses to settle, and then the excess fund gets tapped as a result of their refusal, that the excess fund can then get the money back on a bad faith case against the insurance company. I agree with what you say, and I agree also with Mr. Cooney that I think it's probably inherent in our case law as it exists now, and I would have no objection. In fact, I would be in favor of including it in the bill if we can do that without holding up.
Well, then why don't we do it this way? I suggest we put it in the record that it's the intent of this committee in drafting this legislation that these funds would have the equivalent rights against the primary carrier that, what would it be, the injured person in the ordinary case?
No, it would have the rights that exist currently at common law in Oregon as between primary and excess carriers, which is a little bit different than your insured versus the carrier.
And they have that similar law, the primary and excess carrier has the same?
Yes.
And if you could draft something without spending a lot of time, I always think it's good to clarify something if there's any doubt at all about it.
I agree.
The chair is going to adjourn the meeting and have Joe put this language into proper drafting form and ask Connie and Jerry to work with him. He's going to get the preamble done, and Connie, you have to type it up, and Jerry can paste it in. He'll work next on the next amendment to get it in proper form and put it into our bills, and we'll be back up here at 5 o'clock or 5:30 whenever Jerry says it's ready. But there's no point in us trying to put this stuff into this bill if nobody knows what we're talking about.
How late do you expect that we'll work tonight?
Well, we're going to be on the floor at 7.
Do you want to work after that?
If we have to.
Madam Chairman, I have to leave at 7, I think.
All right. Well, we hopefully, and Joe just had to step out for a few minutes. It's got to be in proper form.
I'll be able to do that
right now. Well, I think maybe he can if he can get at it, and if we can get some people to help, and if you guys will come up with any more changes. So we'll be back up as soon as this bill is, so we can all talk about it. Well, whenever they send a note down, let us know if they're ready.